Hello, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, and Lordy, if you thought there was a tape, there is one. You can find all of our shows archived on the...
Heavens to Betsy,
CFRU.ca.
She must release the tapes, by golly.
/archive/ there ought to be a tape. So, yes.
Hashtag there ought to be a tape. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, or Stitcher. Today we will look at the terrorist attack on London last weekend and the political fallout from that, from Donald Trump's tweets to mischaracterizing London's reaction in the media to the impact on today's national election in the UK. And then we will be talking about that very election with a special guest, John Atkin, a former editor of the BBC. We'll be joining us to talk about the campaign and what we can anticipate when the returns come in. Will Theresa May get her supermajority, or will Jeremy Corbyn and Labour make a surprise showing? And then finally, we will look at the lack of presidential leadership on climate change and how other agencies and governments in the United States are filling that void. But first, we've got 3 out of 5 people. 3 out of 5. New Westminster Burnaby MP Peter Julian was in Guelph last weekend. We got a chance to sit down and talk to him about his own leadership ambitions, and Julian did have some interesting ideas. He's looking to appeal to community groups, social activists, and other sorts of people to build a grassroots base for a real progressive revolution. I asked him about that and how the NDP can take back the left from the Liberals and other issues this past Saturday after his meet and greet at Breezy Corners, which we've taken to call NDP.
NDP hotbed or
NDP headquarters?
With eggs.
So, I mean, it was Saturday morning, so you'll notice a bit of background noise in the beginning there, but please stick through it, and then we'll be back after we hear from Peter Julian.
Just responding after some of the questions and some of the things you talked about.
Yeah.
You're talking about basically integrating all the various movements, using them as, as like a focus group for how the party comes up with its policy and develops its policy, and not the other way around. The party's telling the grassroots what the policy should be. One of the things I was curious about, though, was that what I find with a lot of groups is that some of the groups, it seems like it's all or nothing strategy. It's you believe in exactly what we believe in, and or we walk, and then we call you a politician because you're asking for 1% from us and not taking the 99%. Is there a concern, do you think, that...
Okay, but there's two issues. The first issue is the membership base.
Yeah.
There is a lot of wisdom in the membership. So what I'm proposing is that rather than just sending fundraising emails out, that we're actually having a dialogue and a conversation with our membership on a regular basis, because that will make our work in Parliament and across the country stronger. Secondly, with social movements and environmental movements and labor movements, diversity movements, those are all groups that help to enrich our democracy. And from them, we have a potential of thousands of new leaders joining our party. So we have to be in consultation so that we're lining up for the same vision of the country. That doesn't mean we're going to agree on everything, but I think there's so much common ground given how far we've fallen as a country, how much inequality there is, how much growing poverty there is, how much concern there is about the direction the Liberals are taking to promote, to amplify climate change rather than the kind of smart policies that would actually allow us to transition to clean energy. So there is a lot of common ground. So I'm not worried at all about occasionally having disagreements. That will happen, of course. But I think, generally speaking, most Canadians are saying enough is enough. They voted Mr. Harper out and Mr. Trudeau in because they believe that Mr. Trudeau would change things, and he's not doing that. And that's where I think our inspiring vision can make a difference for 2019.
I only ask because you look at the United States, where you had so many people who supported Bernie Sanders basically give up when the nominee was Hillary Clinton, even though Hillary Clinton adopted a lot of what Bernie Sanders was talking about. But because either her stand in the 90s on violent crime or this and that, or the fact she was kind of a hawk, you know, there was just that one thing that prevented them from getting on board with her.
And as a result, Mr. Right. Trump was elected.
Yes.
Because people bowed out. It wasn't because Mr. Trump galvanized more votes for the Republicans.
Sure.
It was because the Democrats lost the voting base that elected Obama. And so I gather she was not credible on speaking to those issues. We need to be credible on speaking to those issues.
Right.
We need to be credible as a movement. And that's where, circling back, the consultation is so important, because governments don't consult anymore. It's a few backroom people. We saw that under Mr. Harper. We see the same thing under Mr. Trudeau. And they are so out of touch with what the reality is on a day-to-day basis of Canadians. So we can't be that. We cannot be isolated. We have to be integrated and working with community groups and movements right across the country.
I think another concern might be, and maybe you have some ideas about this, but we saw in the last election, I was overhearing some of what you were talking about with another voter, was that Trudeau put on the progressive jacket. He basically put on an orange jacket in the last election, sounding like the NDP leader. We're seeing that in Ontario now with Kathleen Wynne saying, we're going to have $15 minimum wage, socialist paradise, you know, even though it's 1 year away from an election.
And the question then is, does Kathleen Wynne have credibility now?
Right.
And I would argue that she doesn't. Yes, she's trying to adopt NDP policies, but I think people have seen her at work, and I don't think they trust that she's all of a sudden going to be progressive when she's done the exact opposite.
I wonder, though, if that poisons the source for you guys, who are kind of the originators of a lot of this policy, because you see Kathleen Wynne, you see Justin Trudeau, you see other politicians adapt these policies because they see they are winners. And then when NDP members go, who, some of whom, I admit, I've been pledging this stuff for years, go out and then say, we're going to do this, it's almost like they're poisoning the well.
I don't think so if we campaign the way I have laid out, which is the kind of grassroots campaigning where the conversations matter with people. Because when you have somebody talking to other people in the workplace, that individual is saying, this is what the NDP will do. They have credibility. They are working with those people in the factory, on the shop floor. And as a result, they can influence them. In volunteer work, where people are shopping, in neighborhoods where you're knocking on doors to visit your neighbors, it's the credibility of New Democrats going to speak to their neighbors, their workplace colleagues, the people that live in their neighborhood, the people that they volunteer with. That is the credibility that will help bring us to power. So it's not a sterile campaigning through the mainstream media where we put on ads and just expect the public to vote for us. No, we're way past that. There's a very clear cynicism among a lot of the electorate, and it's understandable. They've seen progressively conservatives and liberals breaking their promises regularly. We can't be that party. We have to be a party that sticks to our convictions, even when we're attacked, as I have been on my stand on pipelines. People see that and they say, well, you know, you've taken the attacks, you're holding true. That means that you're committed to this course of action. Those are the kinds of things that make a difference. And then having our activists on the ground, having those conversations, helps to make people see that we are genuine and legitimate, and we are going to make those changes. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. There is a potential for people to say it's never going to happen. The cynicism that we see in North America now is at its height because they've seen so many broken promises. We have to cut through that cynicism by being genuine and being authentic, and also being willing to suffer criticism from the powers that be and the establishment, because we're taking positions that differ from their personal interests. But by seeing us doing that, we help, I think, to convert people to the fact that we are sincere in our commitment for these changes.
You're talking a bit about it seems like going around the mainstream media, and I think part of that is being driven by
wanting to develop a storyline about how there's a schism in the NDP, because now you have the BC NDP coalition government with the Greens, who are very much against pipelines. You have a pro-pipeline government in Alberta. You have LEAP people in favor of the LEAP manifesto. So you have people dubious of the LEAP manifesto. You talked very much about how there are actually ways to not talk about a schism, but talk about, well, are there ways to support things that we can all agree on? How do you avoid, or in so much as combating the one narrative, the narrative of the schism, but and then how do you promote the other side of that, which we were talking about, and not make it seem like there are two realities at play here?
Well, there are two realities at play. There's no doubt. There's a difference of opinion on one specific issue that cannot be reconciled. There's no doubt. On the Kinder Morgan pipeline, there's no way of reconciling that. It's either built or ain't built, and there's no in between. It can't be half built or built for chocolate milk. I mean, we know what the issues are. My sense is the feelings are so high in British Columbia that that pipeline will never be built. And I know John Horgan is committed to using every tool to do that. So we have a wide variety of areas where we're in agreement. One of them is the movement to clean energy. And the Alberta NDP has been a pioneer in many respects on that. And so we have the opportunity to get the federal government to provide the supports that Alberta should have gotten in the first place on a whole range of other issues, healthcare, education, Indigenous issues. We're very much on the same wavelength. Not always, but for the most part. And so it's difficult to talk about a schism when we're talking about one issue.
Right.
It's much, I think, much more accurate to talk about a difference of opinion around the pipeline, but where there are ways where the federal government can play a role and make a huge difference in how Alberta makes the transition to clean energy. And Alberta will benefit enormously from geothermal, wind, and solar power. We just have to have the federal government provide the wherewithal so that Alberta can achieve that.
It does almost sound like the deal breaker, though. The party can agree on all those things, but for one province in particular where the NDP forms government, this is an industry that, even though we can make changes and pursue other industries, it's not going away tomorrow. It's going to be people's livelihood for at least several more years to come.
Yes, but that production continues,
right.
And there are other pipelines. What we're actually talking about when we talk about Mr. Trudeau's pipeline projects, Kinder Morgan, Keystone, and Energy East, is increasing capacity by 2.5 million barrels per day. I mean, that is staggering, and we simply do not have the ability to withstand that increase. Also, by putting the pipelines into place, I hope that the NDP is in power for a long time. But we can't guarantee that.
Right.
And in 20, 30 years, if there's a conservative government in power in Alberta, they've already shown themselves to be appallingly irresponsible around the environment and around climate change. And so building this infrastructure, which lasts 50 years, means that we are permanently wedding Canada as a whole to the raw bitumen export economy for decades to come. And we simply cannot do that if we want to be responsible around climate change.
Well, let me ask you a general question. Why Guelph? I mean, other than the fact that your son is here.
Guelph is a hotbed of activism. Guelph has made a number of innovations around clean energy, as you know. I've been down here. When I was energy critic, I came down to Guelph and actually looked at some of the innovations that Guelph has put into place. District Energy is one example, moving to solar, others. There is another example. So there's a lot of innovation in Guelph, which I think we can be inspired from. There's also a very strong NDP base here, activists that have been active for years. And I also believe that Guelph is a city with the right building that will become an NDP represented city at the provincial and federal level if we work hard to achieve that. So for all those reasons, Guelph for me rates very, very highly, not just for family reasons and the fact I feel at home here, It's the kind of community that I think can make a difference nationally, and I think it's the kind of community that ultimately rejects the old style politics that Mr. Trudeau embodies, saying anything he wants before he gets elected, and then reneging on those commitments once he's elected. And Madame Nguyen represents that same trend, just to say anything, and then once you're elected, forget about those things. I think people in Guelph are real. People in Guelph are authentic, and people in Guelph expect their elected representatives to do what they've committed to do.
Let me wrap up by asking you this question, and I asked Nikki Ashton this as well. In terms of your own qualities, what do you think would make you the best person to lead the NDP? But I would also like to know, in terms of your competitors in this race, what makes them qualified people to lead the NDP?
They're all qualified. I think every candidate is running an extraordinarily strong campaign. We have differences, policy differences, but I have no doubt their hearts are in the right place, and they're working hard, and they're running effective campaigns. What I bring is a difference on the environment that is clear-cut. I'm the only candidate that has taken a stand against the pipelines, taken a stand and proposed a significant investment and shift to clean energy, which will create over 1 million jobs. I come from the shop floor, and that makes a difference. When you've come from the shop floor and worked your way as an adult through school, you have a different perspective. And so coming from the shop floor is another difference that I offer. Coming from British Columbia, coming from the West, but having lived in Quebec for so many years, that is a difference. Western Canada and Quebec, sometimes people say they're irreconcilable, but I'm a Western Canadian MP that's been endorsed by a third of the Quebec caucus. I think that shows a real commitment to national politics and to running the kind of national bilingual party that Jack Layton always wanted to build. So those are points of difference, but I'm very impressed with the other candidates, too. I think they are running marvelous campaigns, and ultimately it'll be up to the membership to decide.
Just responding after...
And once again, that was Peter Julian. He is one of the NDP leadership candidates, and he was in Guelph this past weekend. There is a video, actually there's a two-part video on Guelph Politico where you can hear more from Peter Julian when he was at Breezy Corners last weekend, and we'll just leave it at that.
And we're looking for a clean sweep.
Yes, we are going for the...
We couldn't do all 13 Conservatives, but
we did get one.
We got one.
Good for...
Oh, and Michael Chong, I guess, but that wasn't...
Well, it was
technically.
Well.
You're all welcome.
So two out of 13.
So, just so you know.
As long...
political people out there. All parties.
Yes. So we are have more things to talk about. As you may have seen, there was another terror attack in London this past weekend. 8 people killed, 48 injured. This comes about 2 weeks after the Manchester suicide bombing, which comes about 6 weeks after the attack in that was also on London Bridge. And excuse us. That was the 3 attacks in 3 months. In England, not great optics for the for people wanting to live terror-free, so to speak, in England. But I think the big thing that came of it was a bit mischaracterized. This whole thing about London reeling and in the North American media, and it doesn't that the message coming out of England was like, well, we're not reeling. This is sort of day in the life now. And by the way, we've lived through this 20 years ago, this possibility every day of a terror attack happening somewhere.
Yeah, because I was there, I was young, like 30 years ago was the first time I went to London to see some family. And at that point, it was, everything was IRA. Oh, there's probably IRA going to attack this, that. Same kind of thing, but also different in a way. And yet now it's all come back. I don't think it never fully went away, you know, peace with the IRA, and then now it's ISIS. But of course, yeah, as you were saying about the, oh, London is reeling, but yet, you know, they haven't been to London on a Sunday where it is kind of quiet in the morning, because everybody was out the night before, right? At the pub, enjoying themselves. And of course, yeah, and some of the stories too, like the guy running with the pint glass. I mean, talk about not fazed, or the soccer fan from Millwall. I love that. It's just like, that's the kind of that's the kind of guy you want. that's got your back pretty much. So yeah, those are the, you know, ray of hope stories in amongst the just horrible stuff. And of course, there were other attacks this week too. The attack in Iran and another one in Paris. That. The Paris one was shut down pretty quickly. But the MO seems to be the same as somebody with a knife or whatever is running into a crowd. This is for ISIS. This is for Syria. This is for whoever.
Right.
And the Iran attack was just strange too. There was actual guns involved with that one. But you never hear about an attack in Iran like that.
Even though Iran is one of the partners against ISIS, Iran doesn't like ISIS any more than we do. But I mean, this was. By ISIS standards, it was brazen because they attacked the Iranian parliament and the tomb of Ayatollah Khomeini.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big slap. Yeah, or trying to, anyway.
That is an ISIS bitch slap to Iran.
And that's the thing. It would seem that, to me anyway, that ISIS is getting desperate, or at least their operatives or the people who are aficionados. And this is what's...
aficionados.
Well, no, this is what's different.
I know what you mean.
This is what's different about these attacks than in the past, is that it's a bit more loose. Now, there's always the stories and implication that, they immediately blame the internet's fault. Right. But it would seem that, I mean, there is a degree of socialization as well. It seems that these three attackers were hanging out at some sort of community center swimming pool.
They're at the gym hanging out.
And of course, Muslim women are not allowed to swim publicly like that.
Right.
But yet these guys, it sounds like they were hatching their plan or just kind of hanging out at this pool, and then all of a sudden it's this. So it's not strictly the internet. That's another sort of...
Well, there's multiple levels to this.
Yeah.
First of all, ISIS will put out a statement like, oh yeah, that wasn't one of ours. But, you know, and I said this the other day to somebody, ISIS would claim credit for the destruction of the dinosaurs if they thought they could.
Yes.
There is different levels of sophistication. You have the guy who blew up who did the suicide bomb at the Ariana Grande concert. The suicide vest he used showed a high level of sophistication with explosives. You have the attack in Iran, again, kind of sophisticated because that's a huge terrorist attack in a country that doesn't typically suffer terrorist attacks. Pretty authoritarian regime there that doesn't suffer these things lightly. And then you have these guys who are at the gym, and it almost sounds like, hey, do you guys want to like do like a terrorist attack this weekend? And it's the same with the guy on London Bridge, and it's like it seems highly improvised. We're going to get in a van, we're going to get some long knives, we're going to crash into some people, and then run into a market and start stabbing. I mean, these guys are not Bond villains.
No, but it also shows that gun control seems to be working in the UK better than other places. Because if it was the US, let's say, if they had US style lack of gun control, I think these attacks would be very different. That's not to say there haven't been gun attacks in Britain. There was the Dunblane, and I think the rules changed overnight when that happened.
Yeah.
Already restrictive gun controls became even tighter, if that's possible. So but the other incidents, as you mentioned, where there was the killer of a soldier, Lee Rigby, and same kind of thing. They belonged to a group or were affiliated with a group called Al-Mujahirun, which has been banned. And I think at least half of the attacks in the UK have been half of the attackers and those that attacked were associated with this group. So there is. It's not as if there's completely independent links, and then ISIS is just, you know, they're not just sort of sleeper agents that ISIS awakens. It's a very different structure to say the IRA, which was more, I guess, old school military, if you can say that. And of course, the UK is still under a severe threat of an attack. I think all of the with the election today, polling stations and that were under watch.
Yeah.
Bigger
degree. There was increased police presence.
And I saw that they'd mentioned that the police in Scotland had armed firearm officers, which is a lot of the police, majority of police beat cops in the UK don't carry guns, which I think people find odd as well. But now, mind you, they were able to take these three down in 8 minutes, which is pretty impressive considering they just called it in and they were there. the firearms officers were there right away and took care of business beyond the soccer fans and everybody else who were fighting these guys.
I think they were probably already on a high level alert given Manchester, which was just a couple of weeks ago.
So it's, and that probably isn't going to let up for a while. Mm-hmm. So, and it seems they're also, and I don't know, you know probably a bit more about 4chan than I do, but it seems a lot of these things are hatched on the cesspool that is 4chan. I mean, I can honestly say I've never been there. I believe you have, or...
Oh, sure. I've been on 4chan before. Some of it's
there's like the good 4chan, and then there's the.
I mean, it's like anything on the internet. It's like Reddit. Like, you know, I love Reddit a lot. I love certain subreddits. I go to the Guelph subreddit a lot. So, you know, the Guelph subreddit has been really, really good to me. That's how I recruited a lot of the people who are part of End Credits. It's how I found Bradley, who was substituting for me at the budget meetings last fall, covering those and live tweeting those. But on the other hand, you have stuff like the Red Pill subreddit, which is this awful cesspool of misogyny. You have the Donald subreddit, which is just this like rah-rah cheerleader section of Donald Trump can do no wrong that will block you if you even say, do you think maybe Donald Trump was wrong on issue A? They'll be like, no, you're done. And 4chan's the same thing. There's a lot of fun stuff on 4chan, but there's also a lot of ugliness on 4chan, too. I think, unfortunately, in the last several years, 4chan has become more and more synonymous with the ugly side of the internet than it has with the fun, here's a cool GIF, here's a cool graphic, here's a cool story thing that I think 4chan was associated with about 10 years ago when it started getting rolling. I mean, a lot of hacktivism, anonymous
meme
and stuff
land,
came from, from 4chan as well. So, I mean, there's been good things, but it's kind of cesspool town.
And of course, you can't just blame that. There's multiple factors involved. And it also seems that in this particular attack that they weren't just strictly born in the UK, that there was links to other countries. I guess a couple of them were naturalized citizens. I guess the so-called ringleader, Youssef Zagba, was a Moroccan-Italian, I guess? So it's more of a group, let's call them internationals for lack of a better word, but again, going or attempting to go to Syria, there seems to be the usual stepping stones. It's not just guys slugging away in mom's basement on 4chan and then saying, hey, I'm going to make an attack. It's like there's a definite physical interaction with these groups as well.
Because I think they all met when they worked at a fast food restaurant. Mm. He was the manager, and the other two guys were working stiffs at this fast food place, and I guess they became kind of work friends. The important thing to keep in mind is these weren't refugees who, you know, came across in an inflatable dinghy trying to escape Syria and to infiltrate mainland Europe and make their way to the United Kingdom, because the next part of that was the reaction from old man Trump, who was going on about his travel ban and how the courts and the Justice Department are getting in his way to enact this travel ban. And that's almost a whole separate issue.
Yes.
the point being that he's talking about a problem that doesn't exist with these situations. These are not people who are, to borrow a term, fresh off the boat. These are people who have been part of the background and the cosmopolitan nature of these cities. They grew up there. They have held jobs there. They have friends and family there. Somehow got radicalized. It's not a refugee problem.
Yeah, it sounds like the weird story of Zagba, among other things, was that he was known to police, obviously.
Mm-hmm. A lot of these guys are.
He was investigated because he was trying to radicalize a bunch of kids in a playground. Like, I don't know the whole... of that story,
weird.
But it sounds like even a couple few years ago he was already on that bandwagon, so shouldn't be too much of a surprise. But I guess that's the problem, is that the argument will be, well, if he was known to police, why didn't they round him up? And it's like, well, it's not that simple, right?
That's the Fox and Friends argument, and we won't get into it because
we're not they.
Well, they're not exactly Rhodes Scholars either.
No. Yet we are. Wannabes, anyway, but
we have everything except the invitation to study at Oxford.
More like Randy Rhodes, not Cecil Rhodes, right? Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a break because we have to get our guest on the line, and we're going to talk about the UK election when we get back. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
The courts, the secret handshake, the stock exchange, and the old school tie. For God and Queen and country, things they justify. Above the sound of ideologies clashing.
And that was Billy Bragg from his album Talking with the Taxman About Poetry. I think we used to play that song, or it has been played on Beyond the Ballot Box before, the old incarnation of this show.
It would have had to have been.
Of course. Because if you're thinking UK election, that's the song, at least that's the song I think of. And Billy Bragg will be here for the Hillside Festival July 14th to 16th. He's finally coming to Guelph.
Well, I think he's been here before.
I don't think so. He's very inquisitive.
He must
about,
have been
no,
here before.
I don't think he was. He's very inquisitive about where it was when I talked to him. But now he's going to be. There you go. Anyway.
All right. What do I know?
And we are joined live from the UK. John Atkin from Derby is on the line, former editor of the BBC, and our tonight been pressing the services, our live election reporter. John, how are you doing today?
I'm just enjoying that bit of Billy Bragg there. Right?
Oh, there you go. Sorry, we should have tuned in for the whole song, but
yeah. So, John, you are in Derby, and I imagine there's a lot going on, and in terms of waiting for some of these returns to come in. But first, let me ask. I think a lot of us are wondering over here if there's going to be any sort of effect given the events of last weekend in London and the terror events over the last several months, if you think that will have an effect or an impact on the vote at all.
It's very difficult to say, obviously, what affects the way people vote precisely. The latest news we're getting at the moment, the polling station's closed at 10 o'clock our time, so 35 minutes ago. And as is traditional with the UK general election, there's then announced a big exit poll. 30,000 voters have been polled as they came out of their polling stations. And the indications from that at the moment is that the Conservatives will be the largest party, but they're not going to have a parliamentary majority. Now, of course, that could be, you take your polls with a pinch of salt, but if that was the case, then that would certainly be a big surprise. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd probably have to look at some of the knock-on effects of, and the discussion that's happened since not just the attack in London, but the attack in Manchester as well, the previous attack in London, and ask whether people, have perhaps given some thought to protecting the country and the amount of investment that goes into security.
Mm. So I was having a look at your local news, the Derby Telegraph, just to see, to get an idea of what's going on in your area there. And the headline was excellent. It said, "Here are the issues that are bothering people." That's a line that would never occur here. But it was interesting to see that in your area of Derbyshire and the greater area and Derby itself, that their poll said that the number one and two issues were healthcare and crime. Beyond everything else that's happening, is there any?
You'd probably get the same answer wherever you asked in the country, really, because healthcare, particularly in the cost of healthcare, is a big issue for people, and the future of the National Health Service. How much of our healthcare is going to carry on being free? How much are we going to have to pay for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because here it's always the economy. You ask anybody, it's always the economy. I guess that's just like a North American approach. I notice a lot of the ridings in your area are, some of them were fairly close in the last election. Some of them were obviously a solid, like the famous Dennis Skinner. We even know who he is over here. He's in that same area. He's there till the end, probably, right? It's been a long time for him.
He's a parliamentary legend. And some of the things he says in the house, you think that people with a little less experience might not get away with. The central England area generally is an area that's gone through a lot of change over the last sort of 40 or 50 years. It's gone from being old industrial, coal mining, heavy industry, into sort of new industries, technology, Rolls-Royce jet engines. Bombardier have a big train factory here, a Canadian company. So it's, you know, the nature of the work that people do here and the nature of the people that live here has changed to an extent. And it's, I mean, if you take Derby City Council as an example, it's tended to seesaw between Conservative and Labour control.
Speaking of Labour, we have noticed over here Jeremy Corbyn has sort of gone from, I don't want to call him a joke, but I mean, there certainly at the beginning of this campaign, there was a lot of doubt that he could make a difference against Theresa May. But I did note in he was behind 21 points when the or 24 points when the election began, and now it's 8 points in the poll right before the election.
Yeah, so we're told.
Speaking as someone who's on the ground there, how did he close the gap? How has he, pretty much caught up at least 2/3 of the way to, some people?
I think it's a combination of things. I think partly, you might think that when Theresa May called the election, she felt that she was guaranteed a very heavy victory, that Labour would be sort of ground into the dirt and be an enormous Conservative majority. And it seems to, I think, have perhaps taken some people by surprise that Labour were pretty quickly able to come out with a very well-costed manifesto. They came out with a lot of policies and they said, this is how we're going to pay for them. And arguably, some of that was done more strongly than the Conservatives have done with theirs. But I think what Britain's seeing at the moment, particularly since Brexit, is a real polarisation of opinion. Whereas for a long time, particularly under Tony Blair, you might have said we had sort of centrist policies. I think people are becoming more polarised now. And I think Jeremy Corbyn, although he's been a long-term MP, he's operated outside government for all of that time. You know, he's always been seen as a bit of a political outsider, and I think people have related to that.
Right.
So has this pretty much been the Brexit election? We got the impression that Theresa May's, the whole point was to sort of give her validation for the Brexit. But so it's almost like running the referendum again, I guess. But hearing these polls, it's like it may not be the top issue anymore, or is it?
No, I think that's what she said when she set out. I think that's what she would have liked it to become. You know, her stance was that she and her team were the best people to go into negotiations for Brexit. But I think the security concerns have really overtaken that as being the thing that everybody's talking about, and social care for the elderly as well. The Conservatives came out with a very unpopular plan, which essentially meant that after you died, your house would be sold off to pay for the elderly care that you'd had up until you died. And that really disenchanted quite a lot of their heartland voters, I think. But security, certainly. And what you have to remember as well is that before she was Prime Minister, Theresa May was our Home Secretary for 6 years. So she was in charge of security and the police. And during that period, we lost, 20,000 police officers were cut. Right. And the police warned her that as a result of those cuts, there would be more terror attacks. And I think people have kind of joined the dots now, and that's certainly given her some problems.
So I know that Mr. Corbyn raised that point the other day. So what it sounds like is that there's a lot that people aren't liking about the Conservatives and May, but there's a lot of misgivings too about Corbyn, again, because of that outside status. And I read an article that there were some people in Labour who tend to be more of the Blair centrist variety who were concerned in the last couple of days that he was making kind of a surge and that he could, that, you know, Labour and Corbyn might end up being sort of tied together in much the same way as we see in the United States that Bernie Sanders and the Democrats have been kind of tied together.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, when Jeremy Corbyn even stood for the Labour leadership, he was seen as a bit of a joke figure on the left that stood no chance of being elected leader. When he was elected leader, I think it shocked a lot of people at the centre of the party who felt that, you know, the next leadership should be a kind of procession. Whose turn is it next? And he's certainly been through some real internal party strife, some real internal party wrangling. The way the Labour Party is structured is very complex. It's a combination of local branches, which have their input, and the unions have their input. But it's been noticeable during the more recent campaign that a lot of the people within the Labour Party who are naturally opposed to Corbyn have managed to kind of keep it zipped and have not been doing too much damage.
So we're expecting some returns in the next couple of hours. Looking to, you know, waking up tomorrow, what do you think Britain is or the UK is going to look like, and how do how does the country proceed from there?
Well, it's looking at the moment. I mean, we expect the first one or two results to start trickling in the next 10 minutes or so. Up in the northeast of the country, Newcastle and Sunderland always have a race to see who can declare their result first. but I think the way it's looking at the moment is that, as we did in 2010, we could well wake up in the morning with no party in overall control. Mm. At that point, obviously, we ended up with a coalition government between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. I don't think there's a snowball's chance in hell of that happening again. so we could very easily end up with the Conservatives as the biggest single party, but without a majority and without any kind of formal coalition in place, which would be, you know, almost unprecedented for British parliamentary systems.
And I guess maybe the contenders to a coalition would be the SNP, but they probably wouldn't go in with the Conservatives. It would be highly unlikely.
Not
going to happen in a million years. So. So it should be an interesting night for you.
Yes,
I don't know if you're pulling an all-nighter, but, you know, like you say, when you wake up,
I'm normally up at this time watching baseball, so it's...
Oh, hi, there you go.
Well, John Atkin, we appreciate very much having you on to lend some local color, because otherwise we're two Canadians talking about an election half a world away. So
I'm a half and half. But anyway,
thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, bye-bye.
Thanks, John. Bye.
And so that was John Atkin. He's a former editor of the BBC, on the ground in the B in the BBC. So... we appreciate his time. And I guess, depending on what happens, we might come back to this next week and talk about the results.
Yes, because it could be straight up or it could be...
It's definitely interesting because you see these... I mean, the reason I hit Corbyn so much is because, like, you see these big rallies and you can't help but think of Bernie.
Yeah, but that's the thing. But rallies don't necessarily translate into votes.
And
right?
That's true. So but that's true, too. But rallies equal energy. And for, I think, a lot of people in Labour were expecting... Corbyn would fizzle and they could shove him out the door and then get on with business as usual or unusual. And I think depending on how, on the Labour showing tonight, that might be trickier than they think or hope.
Yeah, because if the polls are anything to go by, well, anyway, we'll talk about it next week.
Yes, next week. For this week, to wrap up, we're going to talk about the environment. I think... Everyone knows both Scotty and I are pro-environment, and one person who, well, we don't know what he thinks, Donald Trump, because people keep asking his spokespeople, does he believe in climate change, and they can't get an answer. But one thing we do know for certain is that Donald Trump was hired to, or elected.
Hired. You got the job, kid.
He was elected to represent Pittsburgh and not Paris. And as such, pulled out of the Paris Climate Change Accord. I think we could all rattle on about how dotty and silly and stupid Donald Trump is doing this. But I think the interesting angle on this, and one of the reasons we want to talk about it, is that it seems that America is carrying on. Hawaii is the first state to pass legislation that basically says they will meet the climate change targets within their own borders. They will take action to meet the targets as outlined in the climate accord. Several other states are kind of forming their own coalition, New York, California predominantly. That's the fourth largest economy in the world, those two states combined right there. And then I think there's like 150 cities that have said they intend to carry on. You have companies like Apple and Tesla, obviously. Even ExxonMobil saying that they will continue with climate change mitigation efforts.
And I believe some of them may have been the signatories to the letter. There was a letter, a joint letter written, I think it was like 1,200 heads of CEOs, mayors, signs saying that no, we're still in. We're not going to give up on this. And like you said, Hawaii have made it law now that they're going to follow that. So I think that's what we're going to see. I wouldn't call it grassroots, but it's operating at different levels. Trump has said one thing, and then everybody else is just going to do their thing and stay in to some degree. Because exactly. We know how many countries? 200? Would that include North Korea? There's only like two.
Well, it's like 100.
Nicaragua and yes. Syria. Is that right?
Nicaragua and Syria were the only non-signatories. Nicaragua, because it didn't go far enough, and who can blame them? Because there's a little thin slip of a landmass yes. on the bottom of Central America.
And Syria, because
Syria obviously has bigger problems at the moment, more immediate problems. And yeah, even Nicaragua, I think last week after Trump made the announcement, some official in Nicaragua said, like, obviously we're going to think about signing it now because we don't want to be in the same group as Donald Trump.
So it'll be everybody, the group of one. The G7 of the G20 is like group of one.
That's a great point because I think Der Spiegel got the transcript or the minutes for the meeting of the G7 where it was like 6-1.
Oh.
And how, you know, everyone was like, these are the reasons you need to stay in. And Donald Trump does the thing that Donald Trump always does, which is like, And then as soon as he gets back to America's shore in front of sycophants and paid staff members, he's like, I told those people I'm getting out because I was elected to represent Pittsburgh and not Paris.
Yeah, the workers who I love.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Ask anybody who works at a Trump Tower how true that is. I'm sure it isn't very much.
The hilarious part is like the mayor of Pittsburgh, Bill Peduto. Like immediately after said like, well, no, I'm going to be doing climate mitigation efforts. Sorry. And by the way, for every Trump voter in Pittsburgh, there were 4 Hillary voters. So it's kind of silly. And then you had Elon Musk, who was on the Business Advisory Council. And he took a lot of crap for being in. Because Elon Musk.
He's
noted
trying to be a coalition builder or whatever.
But. Yeah, and he because he's a noted progressive lefty, sort of like a pinnacle because of SpaceX, because of Tesla and all that. He pulled out. He's no longer sitting on the council. So it was Bob Iger from Walt Disney Corporation. But the most important thing, when you're talking about Musk and Tesla, Tesla now employs more people than the entire coal industry.
Really?
I know a lot of people talk about Arby's employing more people.
Oh,
than
yes.
The coal
yeah, I saw
industry.
That one. Yeah, that Arby's.
But yeah, even Tesla. Tesla's hiring more than the coal industry. And there are more. And if you have like one company alone, you got to figure how many more jobs are sort of tied to green energy and clean production and all these other things, the green economy.
And that's the thing. The country that always comes up in this is China, right?
Yes.
China. How many times did you say that?
China.
But it sounds like China is stepping up now. Their economy right now still is very coal powered, but they are like every other, I wouldn't say progressive country, but forward thinking country in the world are seeing that the coal is limit. You know, there is a limit to how much they can do with that, and are also seeing the potential. And I do believe it is from a capitalist perspective, or at least through a capitalist lens, that there's not only. We need to switch to green energy for the environment, but also because it's potentially a shake your moneymaker kind of thing, as we've seen.
There's a capitalist perspective, but there is also a very practical health concern.
Oh, for
which
sure.
Which is that it's a hot day in Beijing, and the smog comes in. You're walking around downtown Beijing, looking like you're on downtown Mars.
And to hold the Olympics, they had to shut the factories down, right? It's like, okay, you're closed because we can't hold.
They had
this
to kill coal plants like months in advance so they could clear the air,
big
so that nobody, so that athletes don't start dropping dead as they run the 100-meter dash. Yeah, this is you see Beijing on really bad smog days. It's orange colored. The city, it's disgusting. The air is putrid. You could choke on the air. So there's a very practical concern on their end too. But yeah, part of this going forward, speaking of North Korea, they put out a statement on their state media that calling Trump specifically short-sighted and silly, and quote, this is the height of egotism and moral vacuum, seeking only their own well-being at the cost of the entire planet. This is North Korea speaking. If you want to talk about egocentric, look at Kim Jong-un.
Yep.
It's hard to find a more egocentric leader than that.
Yeah, and there's definitely something wrong when it sounds like North Korea is saying the most progressive thing on there. Right. Not the most, but one. They don't sound like they normally do on.
But China smells up. The capitalism argument is important because China smells opportunity. Oh. China smells opportunity to push ahead with their agenda, which is to be the next superpower,
and
that's an economic superpower.
Exactly. China is spending, get this, $1 trillion on infrastructure for roads and rail across Europe and Asia. So
yeah.
they are filling the vacuum, let's say, that's being created by, you know, the gaps that the U.S. used to fill,
mm-hmm.
that developing countries and whatnot would expect help from the U.S. is like, you know, the Marshall Plan, let's say, is an example.
Yeah.
We've got this, you know, Marshall Plan for the 21st century, but coming from the Chinese. And they invest, it's not quite twice as much, but a heck of a lot more in clean energy than the United States does or did using 2016 numbers. I think it was something like $88 billion for China and like $56
billion
for the U.S., somewhere in that range. So they're definitely, you know, added a bit more in those areas. And like I said, seeing that, you know, that it is the future and that it has to be, not just because of the, you know, Paris Agreement, but also, and you know, hopefully it'll be a bit beyond Kyoto, which was inspirational, right? It's a known failure. Like Kyoto is just sort of like, well, you know, one of the big failures in Kyoto was Canada in terms of greenhouse gas. It's like, don't look at the graph because Canada, like, we're some of the worst violators for those numbers.
Well, Jean Chrétien signed on like at the end of his tenure, with, you know, and the intention of kind of leaving a legacy and sort of leaving it in Paul Martin's lap, and then Paul Martin had all the problems he inherited from Jean Chrétien to deal with as well.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. never signed on because it was passed like right before Bill Clinton left office and George W. Bush took over. And there was no appetite on the part of George W. Bush to sign it. Yeah, and then I don't think China or Russia or India signed it either. So, I mean, you're looking at Paris, to get everybody on board at the same time was a truly remarkable feat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of sad that there's really no practical economic environmental reason for Trump to do this. He just did it because kind of just comes because his whole modus operandi seems to be on doing everything Barack Obama ever did.
But of course, when he said it, the traditional energy stocks rose. Coal, oil, gas went up.
But those,
it was just a blip, and they went, I think they've gone back down again.
Right, and it's a short-term benefit.
Yeah.
And they're crowing about creating all these coal jobs, and I guess there was a new coal plant opening or a new coal mine opening in Pennsylvania today, and it's like, this is all incredibly short-term.
Mm.
Because the coal market is going to dry up because
it's
China,
already
India,
in the toilet. It's not as if it's
for
the value
over
of coal
years.
As well. Yeah,
nobody's calling Reagan a coal job killer because it started happening under his watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the nature of the beast. This was the power source of the 19th century. Should it be a surprise that it's going away in the 21st? No, but he's putting all his chips on. I'm not entirely sure if it's genuine or not, because there are intelligent people in the United States in the energy sector who know putting all your chips on bringing coal back is not sustainable.
No.
And it's not going to happen. Anyway, we're going to have to call it there. That's it for this week's show. I would like to draw your attention to Wednesdays at 8 a.m. for the End Credits Show. That's the new movie news and movie review show I host with a panel of local movie fans. And you can check that out Wednesday at 8 a.m. I also want to plug another thing about myself. I will be at the I'll be at the 12th Annual Poverty Symposium held by the Social Planning Council of Cambridge and North Dumfries next Thursday in the day. So that's before the show. And I will be part of a panel discussing solutions to poverty includes media, and I will be representing New Media, obviously. So if you have next Thursdays off and are interested in the topic, you can get tickets for the symposium at Eventbrite, and I think it'll be very interesting. So check that out. I do have a link on the Guelph Politico Facebook page if you want to have an easier time finding that. As for open sources, opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter, and of course you can get this episode and other previous episodes of Open Sources on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean and through your iTunes or Stitcher, whatever you listen to podcasts on, whatever app on whatever device. You can stay connected to me at Adam Adolz on Twitter or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, blog at the Spanner Book. Sorry, I blew it this weekend, but it's coming.
Blew it.
It's in the pipe. And in terms of self-promotion, I don't really have anything, but I could come up with something. Next show.
Next show.
I'm going to be listening to the Wednesday show. I'm very excited about the movie show.
Thank you. Where was I going with this? I was going to throw it to DJ Sounds Good to Me. I believe it is a rerun of DJ Sounds Good to Me, but it's still good music. More good programming coming up on CFRU. That's CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And be back here next week, Thursday at 5, for more open sources. See you then.